trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Okay, I think I brought 95% of my voice today, so, you know, I got that going for me. And I'm glad you're here. Welcome to a place where we revel in wrongthink. This means challenging some of the prevailing narratives and, above all, trying to think as clearly and independently as possible. And as you're going to see in the course of today's show, there's a very concerted effort to try to keep us separated from reality. In fact, it's kind of, that's one of the measures of are you being a good citizen or not, is are you willing to deny reality? I got details on that coming up in a few moments. Our program is brought to you by MonticelloCollege.org, also LifesavingFood.com, and the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. Well, here's a great place to start today. Let's talk about the divisions that have been created by the various COVID policies, among other things. There are other things that are feeding this, but it's been very interesting to watch how divided we've become over issues like masks and vaccines and social distancing and lockdowns and so forth. And I understand it's super tempting to categorize people who hold a different point of view than you do as being evil, being either evil or stupid. I mean, this is kind of the default setting for, I think, a lot of us, and I've been guilty of this too. What, you don't agree with me? Well, you are either motivated by pure satanic evil, or you're just stupid. You know, if you had a brain, you'd be outside playing with it. And that's not true. That's not correct. See, the reality is, most of those who hold views that that lean very heavily towards, you know, greater authoritarianism, more control, more top-down dictates telling everybody this is how you're going to do it, has to do with the fact that people are simply afraid. And I came across a great article by Thomas Harrington. This was published on the Brownstone Institute's website, brownstone.org. If you haven't subscribed, there is marvelous information. This is one of the best resources you could have in terms of having a good, objective take on particularly some of the COVID things. But Thomas Harrington describes the frightened class and how they have bought into the fear that's being pumped at us around the clock. He says they're all around us, especially those of us who live in relatively prosperous metropolitan neighborhoods in the U.S. or Western Europe. And despite being, at least in material terms, among the most fortunate people who've ever walked the earth, they are very scared. And they want you to be very frightened, too. In fact, many of them see your refusal to be frightened, or as frightened as they are, about life's inevitable risks. They see that as a grave problem, which entitles them and their often powerful and influential fellow travelers to recur to all manner of authoritarian practices to ensure that you adhere to their increasingly neurotic view of reality. Now, this tendency, he says, has been in full bloom lately as the people who've sat safely behind their laptops during the past 20 months have harangued and threatened those who've been out on job sites and meatpacking plants mixing freely with others and the virus to internalize their own obsessions. Thomas Harrington says, and when these supposedly ignorant others, whose storehouse of empirical evidence about the dangers of the virus easily outstrips that of the laptoppers, when they refuse to buckle to the demand to be scared, well, they're met with all kinds of opprobrium. Now, viewed in historical terms, he says, this is an odd phenomenon. For most of recorded time, prosperity and education have been the gateway to a life of relative freedom from worry. But now, Thomas Harrington says, the people who most enjoy these benefits are, it seems, racked with anxiety, and in the not infrequent way of many people suffering that plague, they are hell-bent on sharing their misery with others. Now, he says, the point here is not to belittle the very real costs of anxiety in the lives of many people, nor to dismiss it as a real public health concern. He says, rather, It's to ask how and why it is proliferating so rapidly among those who, at least on the surface, have less reason than the vast majority of their fellow human beings to suffer from it. I think that's a fair question. And he says there are a number of possible explanations. Thomas Harrington says one way of explaining the phenomenon is in the context of income inequality and its devastating effects on the shape and size of the upper middle class and those who still believe they have a realistic chance of joining its ranks. Those who have made it into that subgroup are deeply cognizant of the unstable nature of their status in a world of corporate buyouts and rampant layoffs. And they worry that they may not be able to provide their children with the ability to retain what they see, rightly or wrongly, as the only real version of the good life. So when people way up on top made the decision following September 11th to make the inducement of fear the cornerstone of political mobilization in an increasingly post-political and post-communal society, well, they found a ready reserve of support in this anxious, if also relatively prosperous, cohort of the population. And he says, after 2 decades of having their already anxious inner selves massaged daily by a steady drumbeat of fear and a diet of Trump as Hitler for dessert, both they and their children fell like ripe fruit into the hands of those that wanted to sell them on the unprecedented threat posed by a disease that leaves 99.75% of its victims wonderfully alive. Now, adding another layer to this general phenomenon is the increasing isolation of our educated classes from physicality in both their work and communal lives. Think about it. Till the 1990s, it was virtually impossible for anyone other than the richest of the rich not to have any active or passive acquaintance with the world of physical work. Indeed, for the first 3 or 4 decades after World War II, many of those who could afford financially to relieve their children of this acquaintance with physical work often did not do so because they believed that knowing what it meant to sweat, ache, to be crushingly bored and not infrequently humiliated during the course of the day was essential to gaining a more rounded and emphatic understanding of the human condition. And all that ended when the financialization of the economy and the rise of the internet made what Christopher Lash presciently termed the rebellion of the elites a much more palpable possibility. Thomas Harrington says, for example, very few of my students have ever worked during their summers in anything other than office jobs, often procured through family connections. So they have very little understanding and hence little empathy of just how brutal and demeaning daily work can be for so many people. He says this alienation from the physical can also be seen in family life. The predominant and seldom challenged edict of go where the money is a virtual religion for those seeking upward advancement in U.S. culture, and it's also meant large numbers of children now grow up far away from their extended families. However, we seldom talk about the built-in costs of subscribing to this ethos. Thomas Harrington says to talk with and listen to grandparents, uncles, and aunts on a regular basis and in person is very different from seeing these people in occasional choreographed holiday rituals or from time to time on Zoom. In the first instance, the child is inserted into a milieu that, for better or worse, structures his understanding of how the world works and forces him to recognize his relationship to both the past, other people, and their individual stories. Now, might they decide later for very good reasons to break for this particular network of narratives? Of course. But when they do so, they will at least carry with them the idea of a stable and rooted identity as a life goal. He says the increasing distance between those working within the antiseptic confines of the information economy and those still earning their keep with their bodies has led many of the former group into a state of enormous confusion regarding the distinction between words and deeds. He says that's why so many of them, parroting the moralizing, if factually tenuous talking points supplied to them by a deeply corrupt media establishment, are so nonplussed about the physical assaults upon people's bodies now taking place in the name of fighting COVID. And it's also why a disturbing number of those whom they teach truly believe that hearing someone utter a critique against an ideological construct that another person told them was good and correct is much more problematic than forcing someone to be injected with an experimental drug under the guise or under the threat of losing their livelihood. Pretty interesting stuff. Worse yet, he says these self-frightened elites think they can remedy their lack of credibility with those living outside of their grim prison of angst simply by pumping up the volume on the scare machine. But he says, I suspect they may be in for a bigger and much more physical set of responses than they ever imagined could come their way. There's more to this article. I would encourage you, click on it, read it for yourself. I've got it in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. And this is one of many, many resources for wrong thinkers like you and me that I happily supply each day that I do this program. Check it out for yourself. We'll be back in just a few moments after I have a quick sip of tea.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I want to bring a guest on board, and I'm going to just throw this disclaimer out there. This segment is not intended to be an infomercial, but we're going to talk to Kendall Whiting. Kendall is one of my sponsors through lifesavingfood.com. And Kendall, thank you, first of all, for joining me on the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me on, Brian.
I'm glad to have you here. I wish that we had something really lighthearted and fun to talk about, but I want to give my audience just an idea of what you are seeing as a person who retails, you know, emergency preparedness foods, you're pretty tapped into some of the supply chain issues that we're starting to see now. We've been talking for quite some time about how, you know, it's good to be self-reliant. It's good to have a food storage program. And now we're actually starting to see some breakdowns in the supply chain affecting the food storage industry. Talk to me about the letter that you received earlier this week from ReadyWise Foods.
Yeah. So on Monday, I recently got a letter saying basically that the prices will be increasing. These will only apply to the meat buckets, though, that I sell. But I could actually quote, let's see, I have the letter in front of me also. It says, quote, over the last quarter, we have experienced significant increases in commodity pricing, freight, and labor costs. We are unable to continue absorbing the increasing costs impacting our industry. And this is from the CFO from my supplier.
Okay. Now, I know when prices go up, sometimes people are tempted to think, well, that's just, you know, businesses or manufacturers being greedy. But I appreciate you coming on my program to talk a little bit about this letter that you received from the CFO of ReadyWise Food saying, look, we've tried to absorb these costs as long as we can, but there comes a point where you can't keep absorbing those costs and stay in business. You have to raise your prices in accordance with how your costs are going up.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're exactly right in saying that some people think it's the greediness of these businesses and corporations, whereas, they make it pretty clear in this letter that they've done all they can to minimize the costs through productivity improvements, through automation, through third sourcing. It's pretty clear that, you know, the prices have been going up because of the supply and demand.
Right. And I hope by now people are starting to get the picture and not, you know, oh, we're all doomed, but just look, if you're going grocery shopping, you're seeing it. Not only are the prices going up, but there are certain things that are in fairly high demand that are pretty tough to come by. And so you're seeing lots of gaps on the shelf. It doesn't take, you know, too much of an imagination to understand why that could extend to other areas of the food supply chain, including, you know, those emergency provisions and preparedness provisions that people may be wanting to put up. Are you hearing any other rumbles from anywhere else, you know, throughout the food storage industry?
Just in general, like when I go to the grocery store or anywhere else, like you've been talking about in your previous episodes, there's been a lot of empty shelves. The meat and all the stores have been going up in price, and just
big
in
time.
General, the restaurants. And So that's why I think the meat buckets have gone up, just because overall they've gone up in throughout the industries. And I did a little bit of calculating, actually, and I calculated it was around 20% increase on the meat buckets.
Yeah, that's one that I think most of us feel. I look back with fondness on the days when, you know, I could go shopping for steaks, and there would, you could usually find a decent steak for, you know, between $5 and $10, and that sometimes you shop the discount meat bin. I wasn't too proud to do so, but holy cow, I swear it. When it comes to shopping for meat now, and we're not talking steak, I'm talking things like chicken or even pork. There's a very noticeable increase in price. Ribs used to be a great favorite. Now I'm like, well, maybe only on special occasions. they're really spendy.
It's so true. You almost have to like save up to eat some meat now. Like you have to like treat it as if it's something like you can only eat like once a week, not something you can just purchase every day and eat every day anymore. You have to really plan ahead and budget for it.
Well, I appreciate you sharing some insights on this with us. You know, it's not to tell people, hey, you know, don't even bother now. It's all gone or it's all too expensive. There is still plentiful supply out there. But the reality is prices are going up because the cost of doing business is going up. They mentioned, you know, for instance, transportation and you know, the cost of gas goes up. Guess what? So does the price of everything, literally everything else.
Yes. And there's a big backup right now, too. For instance, the vegetable buckets I sell, they're not going to be back in stock until early November. So I had to put a halt to that. And I wouldn't be surprised if I saw other categories where things are slowing down and there's a huge demand and the supply is going down because things can't come into our country as fast.
Yeah, I know that the rumblings are it's going to be a very interesting Christmas. So here's my suggestion. If you're going to give Christmas gifts, give the kind of Christmas gifts that will actually improve someone's standing. And I'm talking things like water filters. I'm talking things like, you know, food storage, those grab and go buckets or people may turn their nose up at one point. They'd be like, why would you give us food storage? I think this is one of those times where people would be like, oh, thank you. I could actually see this being useful, you know, down the road.
Yeah, our family, we usually do like a white elephant gift themed thing or game, I guess. And I'm thinking of just doing like a food storage bucket or something.
Wow.
Maybe that'll be the desired gift or something.
I was going to say it's going to be the most sought after gift that there is. Well, so. I appreciate you keeping us, you know, up to speed on this. Again, I feel like I walk this tightrope every single time I talk about these kind of things, and I really don't want people to be afraid. I don't want them to be panicky and like, get me the credit card, honey. We got to do this now.
Yeah.
This is something you need to be thinking about, but it's an unpleasant truth that we really need to face. And, you know, when you start to see truly empty store shelves and when it's clear things will not be coming back in to replace what's gone from those shelves, I just can't think of a better time to have some peace of mind in knowing that you took the time to prepare, you took the time to set aside something for a time when it wouldn't be easy to get those things. And, you know, we're probably also going to have to adjust some, but I think there's more peace of mind in this than that horrible look that was in people's eyes, you know, in mid-March of 2020 when it was clear they're going to lock everything down. And boy, if you don't have what you need, you may be scrambling. You may be fist fighting somebody, you know, over toilet paper. I hope it doesn't come to that, but
Yeah, I don't either. I think people just, what we can do, I guess, is just set aside a budget, just monthly or weekly or however you want to do it, and just start chipping away at it. You don't need to buy, you know, the full year supply all in one purchase or anything, but you can just purchase a little bit at a time.
Just like anything else in life, consistency will get you really great results. And the one thing I've observed with food storage, it doesn't take long to start really adding up. You know, you may feel at first like, well, I don't know if I'm really getting anywhere, but a couple of months down the road, if you're being consistent, you'll start to notice, hey, that's a pretty nice stash. And I can't explain, but it makes me feel good when I look at it. Kendall Wyden, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today.
I'm glad you invited me too. Like I was like, oh yeah, Brian Hyde. Like, you, I don't know. I was super excited to come on, and I just want to say too, I'm grateful for all you've done and furthering the cause of freedom and liberty.
You are very kind. And folks, again, in full disclosure, Kendall is one of my sponsors here on the show, but he's the kind of sponsor I really would want you to be acquainted with, because he's dialed into some things that are really important. We will take a break. We'll be back just the other side of these messages.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there, and welcome back to the show. It is so good to have you as part of my audience. And I would ask this favor: if you find something of value in the show, please tell a friend about it. Drop them a note. Let them know that they can. You can subscribe and actually receive my show notes every time I hit publish. It'll send it right to your email. This is for those of you, I know that not everybody has time to listen to the full 2 hours of the show. Not everybody wants to listen to me, and I'm okay with that. That's absolutely fine. But I do put together these show notes with the idea that if you're looking for good information, wanting a better understanding of the world around us, this is a good place to start. Not because I have all the answers, but I'm constantly on the prowl for good, solid, principled information. Boy, did I find a great one, too. In Vasco Kollmeyer's latest essay, you know, of all the battles being fought around us, the one in which every single one of us has a stake is the war that's being waged against reality. This is the great struggle of our time, the battle for reality. Listen to what Vasco Kollmeyer has to say. He says, with societal turbulence all around us, many people feel that we're locked in some great and portentous struggle. But because it's so pervasive and multifaced, the nature of this struggle isn't always readily obvious. Now, there are many fronts on which this struggle is being fought. You'll see it in racial relations, education, healthcare, popular culture, the financial system, even freedom of speech, among others. And Vasco Kollmeyer says, it's not easy to make sense of it all, especially since the battles are highly pitched and emotions are running very high. What characterizes these battles, besides their deep intensity, is their deep polarization. The possibility of the warring camps coming together and meeting on some common ground seems to be growing more distant by the day. In fact, there's even talk that the two sides will come to blows, or they'll go their own way in some form of secession. Now, many have observed that the contenders seem to be separated by an unbridgeable gap, and yet no one has been able to explain the nature of this gap or what exactly it is that separates the mindsets of the opposing sides. So Vasco Kollmeyer says, in our view, the struggle in the grip of which we find ourselves cuts much deeper than the immediate issues that we're arguing over. The real fight extends beyond any particular point of public friction. In fact, he says, the great battle of our time is a battle about the very nature of reality. More precisely, what the two sides war over on the most fundamental level is what constitutes truth and how it should be determined. Now, to shed light on this dynamic, he says, let's take one of the most heated controversies of the present time. For this, we choose transgenderism. Now, this is an especially suitable example for two reasons. This issue is highly divisive and polarizing, and it delineates the opposing camps sharply and clearly. As you may know, transgender advocates claim that biological males can become women and vice versa. Now, understandably, many people find this claim rather far-fetched. For one thing, it doesn't feel true, given that the evidence of our senses seems to refute it. For example, people look at transgender women, in other words, biological men who say they are women. Most people immediately recognize that's not a real female. What most people see is men who pretend to be girls. That's how the human mind, in the vast majority of instances, interprets sensory input that it receives upon encountering such persons. And yet transgender advocates vehemently maintain that's not the correct interpretation of the visual data. They insist that what's in front of our eyes are not men who pose as girls, but real girls. And the claims of transgender advocates thus run in direct contravention to what we perceive to be the case with our own eyes. In other words, transgender supporters attempt to negate and override our perception of reality. In essence, what they're telling us is reject the appearance of your eyes, or the evidence of your eyes, rather. What is in front of you is not a man who tries to appear as a woman, but a genuine woman. And they often insist on this point with great vehemence, so vehemently, in fact, that they want to punish and penalize those who dare to say otherwise. They call such people transphobes, among other things, and have them canceled and fired from their jobs. They also charge them with the offense of misgendering, which has now become a crime in some places. To put it another way, it's now becoming a crime to honestly declare reality as it is presented to us by our sensory apparatus. And it raises the question, too. I mean, look, you want to treat people well. I think that's noble. But to what degree are you obligated to participate in their perception? I was going to say their fantasy, but I'm trying to be diplomatic. Now, in Vasco asks the question here, can it be possible that our senses may deceive us in some way? After all, sometimes our senses do paint an inaccurate picture of the world. For example, when we put a stick in water, the stick appears to be bent at the point where it touches the water's surface. Well, the good news is we don't have to rely on sight alone when trying to make the determination of whether someone is a man or a woman. In this modern era, we're fortunate to possess precise and reliable scientific means for making this determination. As you may know, males and females are born with different chromosomal structures. Chromosomes are made of strands of DNA that are stored in the nuclei of our cells. Both sexes have 23 distinct pairs of chromosomes, of which 22 are the same, but the last one differs markedly. In men, the 23rd chromosomal pair takes the form XY, while in women its form is XX. So our sex is thus a biological reality that's encoded in the deepest physical level of our being. Nearly every one of some 30 trillion cells in our body bears witness to whether we're male or female. Now, this fact is incontrovertible. It cannot be altered. As matters stand now, mankind does not possess technology or scientific means to change this fact, and it's unlikely it ever will. From the moment of our conception, our sex is irrevocably hardwired deep in the very physical substratum of our existence. And yet, transgender advocates claim that those with XY chromosomes, in other words, biological men, can suddenly and at whim become women, and those with XX chromosomes, biological females, can become men. Now, transgender activists go so far as to profess that this impossible traversing of the man-woman dichotomy can be affected by mere wishful thinking via arbitrary self-identification with the opposite sex. Thus, in addition to denying the evidence of the senses, transgender advocates also deny biological and physical aspects of reality as presented by science. And because of this, the transgender movement represents a brazen and complete negation of reality in all of its aspects and dimensions, sensory, commonsensical, historical, biological, physical, and scientific. To fully understand the context of our larger societal struggle, he says it's important that we realize that the transgender ideology is a wholesale denial of truth. It constitutes a complete inversion of reality on all levels. And because of its uncompromising negation of fact, transgenderism represents gaslighting at its most extreme. Now, if this flagrant subversion of fact was confined only to the transgender movement, that by itself would be reason enough for serious concern. But Vasco says, here's something truly alarming. The kind of wholesale denial of reality that we're seeing is emblematic of the whole of the American political left as it stands in 2021. Whereas before such levels of absurdity were mostly the domain of the left's fringes, today they permeate the whole of it. And this, of course, includes the mainstream of the Democrat Party. Now, if you think this is an exaggeration, he says, contemplate this. On the very day of his inauguration, Joe Biden signed an executive order number 13988 called Executive Order on Preventing and Combating Discrimination on the Basis of Gender Identity or Sexual Orientation. Now, Biden's directive seeks, among other things, to force schools to allow boys who declare themselves girls to compete in sports with genuine biological girls. And it's revealing. It's as revealing as it is significant that Joe Biden did this on his very first day in office as president of the United States. As soon as he assumed power, the standard bearer of the Democratic Party tried to impose by executive fiat a brazen negation of reality upon this nation. And more alarmingly still, Joe Biden is still widely considered to belong to the moderate wing of his party. So the question arises, well, if this is what moderates do, what are the designs and goals of the party's more radical elements? The fact that Biden issued the edict on his first day shows that transgenderism is not some peripheral cause held by leftist radicals. And this issue is central to the Democrat mainstream. Now, this shows the willful and deep moral corruption of the party in its current incarnation. I mean, we're talking willful denial of truth is the most severe of transgressions. This is apparently the primary offense of the one whom the good book calls the father of lies. And apparently the Democrat establishment is following well in his path. We're going to come back to this article in just a few moments. Again, this is from Vasco Kollmeyer, and it's a doozy. I agree, though, and you've heard me refer to the problem of being separated from reality. That's the toughest thing right now, is maintaining your grip on it while everybody and everything, the different institutions and people, are telling you, no, that's not true. We'll come back to this in just a few moments.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Quick shout out to the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage in St. George, Utah. You can swing by their office at 619 South Bluff Street. You can call her on the phone at 435-703-4522. If you are looking for a home loan, whether it's a VA loan, a traditional loan, a reverse mortgage, maybe want to refinance your existing home loan, if you are within the state of Utah, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage is there to help you. Heather's NMLS ID is 715386. Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. She's got decades of experience. She can get the job done, and most importantly, get it done quickly. I've got a link on my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. It's an email link that'll take you directly to Heather. I want to take advantage of that if you are looking for a home loan. So back to this article by Vasco Kollmeyer about the great struggle of our time, the battle for reality. And I know for some people it may sound like, well, you sure just, you know, got an axe to grind with the transgender people. And I don't say this to suggest that, boy, you should be rude and you should treat people poorly. Most of us, whether you want to admit it or not, know someone who is struggling with gender identity issues. And it's not a light thing. I mean, the suicide rate is very, very high for people who are struggling with this issue. I'm not convinced that indulging the fantasy and furthering it is necessarily doing them a favor. But I want to make absolutely clear, I'm not advocating, boy, we should be shouting them down and, you know, making them feel shamed. I don't think that's necessary. I do think, though, that you have to assert your prerogative and your sovereignty, if you will, to hold on to reality. Because right now, there is a faction that is very much trying to convince you that you should turn loose of reality and cling to whatever they say is reality. Again, going back to Mr. Kollmeyer's article here, he says, the well-being of so-called transgender people is not what Joe Biden and his handlers really care about. After all, Joe Biden had never been known to be particularly friendly toward LGBT. It's the movement's proclivity towards reality negation that those who pull the strings of this frail man find so appealing. So they've appropriated the transgender cause because it allows them to gaslight the American people, and gaslighting has become the left's modus operandi. Oh, you don't believe me? Watch the network news. It's gaslighting in every sense of the word. And it's done with a straight face. You're expected. You should believe this. Gaslighting is now an integral part of the left's every move, and it's sowing confusion and wreaking havoc everywhere. The gaslighters have already managed to disorient many people and weaken their hold on reality. They correctly sense that if they press sufficiently hard, they will be able to take advantage of the disarray and implement their godless, nihilistic, inhuman, love-deprived, and freedom-hating agenda. Vasco Kollmeyer says, should they succeed, we will find ourselves living in a dystopian nightmare ruled by totalitarians. That's why the great battle of our time is the battle for reality against those who aspire to negate it. This is what the current struggle is ultimately about. I just have to nod in agreement. Yeah, I think he's right. I think he's absolutely correct. All right, moving on. The term enemy of the state carries some pretty serious baggage, right? Nobody really wants to be designated as an enemy of the state. But as Jeff Minnick, writing for intellectualtakeout.org, writes, once you understand what the state is actually up to in regards to trying to separate you from your natural rights, being labeled an enemy of the state ought to be a badge of honor. Minnick says, all my life I've felt a bond with places and with people. Growing up in Boonville, North Carolina, population then about 600. He says, I went to elementary school in the Methodist Church, knew many of the merchants in town, Harvey Smith, grocer and mayor for many years, Donald the barber, Mr. Weatherwax, who owned the pharmacy, and was kind enough to let me read comic books on the premises, and a dozen more adults. And he says, and I relished my friends and family. Boonville's red clay and rolling hills are as much a part of me as any genetic code. And then there are the other places I've lived, New York, Connecticut, Boston, California, Charlottesville in Virginia, Waynesville and Asheville in North Carolina, and for the last 5 years, Front Royal in Virginia. That became home to me, one for only a year, one for 20 years, but always home. Now Minnick says, this was the case because all around me was my country, a people and land joined together under a flag. That aspiring physician in Charlottesville who brought flags to every classroom in his son's school and taught the kids the Pledge of Allegiance, the old-style liberal in North Carolina, a good friend who recognized the flaws of our country, but also its grandeur, my lovely wife putting out small American flags along the sidewalk of our bed and breakfast every Independence Day. These and a thousand other people and events have connected me to the goodness of this beautiful country in which I live. But he says those same affectionate emotions don't extend to the state, in particular the federal government, especially given their recent actions. There's a name for the situation where government servants become government masters. It's called tyranny. And in the last 250 years, our nation shifted from a republic with a central government of limited powers to an oligarchy of politicians, bureaucrats, corporations, and some in the mass media, a conglomeration that today seeks to rule every aspect of our lives. These are the people who constantly proclaim themselves as wise and benevolent rulers who only wish the best for their subjects. And they're failing on every front. Federal aid and regulations have damaged our elementary and secondary public schools. Federal aid to our universities has brought inflated tuition and massive student debts. Federal regulation has proven catastrophic for our healthcare system. We lose the wars we fight not because of the courage of our soldiers, but because those in power often make ignorant decisions. Oh, and that same government has spent us into perpetual debt. Now, the list goes on, but Jeff Minnick says it's the Chinese virus that revealed both the tyranny and ineptitude of our government. The lockdowns were disasters for small businesses and schools. The unconstitutional mandates demanding all citizens receive an experimental vaccine are further damaging everything from our airlines industry to our hospitals, as employees walk away or are fired for their refusal to take the jab. Meanwhile, while some places restrict access to restaurants, movie theaters, and other public venues to the vaccinated, our southern border has become a highway for refugees, none of whom are vetted for the vaccine. Defense from invasion, which should be the first job of government, has gone missing. And that's effectively where we are today. For nearly 2 years, prompted by a virus, the federal government and some of our state governors have bullied, threatened, harassed, and intimidated the American people. They've used fear and division as their cudgels to keep us cowed and beaten down. But he asks, are we finally seeing a rebellion against these tyrants? If we carefully sift through the information our censors still allow to appear online, Jeff Minnick says, I believe a revolt is already in the making in America. That nurse who decides to maintain sovereignty over her body and walks off her job is a model of heroism. That parent who confronts a school board for teaching critical race theory or for allowing boys into the girls' locker room is leading a charge against government. That university professor who won't buckle when falsely accused of racism is a splendid foot soldier in this rebellion. And the refusal of certain congressional Democrats to support an insane spending bill indicates at least some of them are in touch with their constituents. Now, Jeff Minnick says, we Americans have been asleep for a long time now, failing to surveil our politicians and bloated bureaucracy. As our Declaration of Independence tells us, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. In the very next sentence, however, this same document states that when the people suffer from a long train of abuses and usurpations, then it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government. A few years later, the founders then devised a constitution with its separation of powers and Bill of Rights that reflects their fears of a tyrannical government. Now, Jeff Minnick says, like those ancestors, today's Republicans, Democrats, liberals, and conservatives would be wise to regard the state as an enemy, not a friend. I know that there's a time that would have sounded really, really radical, but given the things that are going on around us, does that strike you as, you know, quite as out there as it might have at one time? I like how George Washington put it. He equated government to being like fire, a dangerous servant and a fearful master. There's a reason why the powers were clearly enumerated in the Constitution to prevent people who saw opportunity or who saw the opportunity for mischief, to be more precise, to keep them from engaging in said mischief. So if you are standing up for things like natural rights, like personal freedom, like freedom of conscience, private property rights, etc., you're standing on the right side of history. And if that makes you an enemy of the state, wear it as a badge of honor. And I'll be standing right there beside you.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.